Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode on Thursday, November 13th, 2025, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated, and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this week's episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. Judge rejects claims that Arizona's sex offender registry violates constitutional rights. Trump pardons 11 Arizona fake electors as Attorney General faces deadline to refile her case. Arizona Democrats blast 7 senators who caved on healthcare demands. Student advocates demand ASU follow UA in rejecting Trump's education compact. And let's get started. Our first story: judge rejects claim that the Arizona Sex Offender Registry violates constitutional rights. The state is justified in tracking residencies and online identities of convicted child sex offenders, the court ruled. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, November 11, 2025. A federal judge shot down a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of Arizona's sex offender registration laws, ruling that the state is justified in tracking the residencies and online identities of people convicted of crimes against children. It is plain that Arizona has a significant governmental interest in protecting children and preventing sex offender recidivism, Judge Stephen McNamee wrote in a November 6th order. 2 years ago, a man convicted of sexual contact with a minor in 2016 filed a lawsuit against multiple sex offender registration statutes, arguing that they violate his free speech and due process rights. The man, who was granted anonymity by the court due to his fear of receiving threats of violence, is referred to as John Doe. He sought to nullify laws that require him to register as a sex offender for life, report any online identifiers he uses, and register his residency every time he stays in a new county for 3 or more days. Online identifier reporting requirement. Under Arizona law, a person convicted of a crime against a minor must present themselves to the sheriff's department of the county they live in to be fingerprinted and registered as a sex offender. During that time, they must also share every name they're known by, the car they drive, if they have legal custody of a child, their address, and any online identifier they use, along with every website that identifier is used on. Doe claimed that requiring him to share his online usernames and activity is tantamount to infringing on his freedom of speech, and said that he worried it could be used to expose his identity to the public. But McNamee rebutted that Arizona law doesn't allow for the public disclosure of any personal information tied to the online identifiers sex offenders use. The only way the two could be linked is if a person has a lawful reason for asking for it and submits a sex offender's fingerprints to the sheriff's office with that request. McNamee also disagreed that the law infringes on Doe's free speech rights, pointing out that the law doesn't make any attempt to restrain what he says online. Instead, the law merely seeks to monitor where sex offenders engage online. Although Arizona's registry scheme makes speaker-based distinctions, the reporting requirements themselves are content-neutral, McNamee wrote, adding, Arizona's internet identifier reporting requirements do not bar Doe from engaging in online discourse. Lifetime registration. Doe is classified as a level 1 sex offender, the lowest of three tiers. In his lawsuit, he argued that Arizona's law requiring all sex offenders to register for life without regard for their classification levels fits the definition for cruel and unusual punishment and violates his right to due process because he can't contest that requirement in court. Doe argued that as a level 1 sex offender, his risk of recidivism is lower than those in other tiers, and he should be able to challenge the mandate to register for life because of that. But McNamee noted that Arizona's lifetime registration requirement is triggered by a conviction, making any hearing centered around whether Doe should have to register as a sex offender for life moot because he already had his day in court. His conviction was a necessary precursor to his lifetime registration. Registration was required by the fact of conviction as a sex offender, thus rendering any additional process superfluous, McNamee wrote. Residency reporting requirements. Doe also challenged Arizona's mandates regarding sex offender address notification. Two laws cover different parts of the address reporting requirements. One of them appears to address changes in residency, requiring sex offenders to report their address within 72 hours after changing it, or after moving to or from the person's residence to a different county. Doe has homes in two different counties and said that he is forced to register each time he moves between the two, regardless of the length of time he spends at each, for fear of facing legal repercussions because the language in that statute is too vague. But in court filings, Doe and his opponents in the case, Republican legislative leaders Warren Peterson and Steve Montenegro, agree that the statute refers to an intent to move from one residence to another permanently and shouldn't apply to people with more than one home. Given that agreement, McNamee ruled that Doe's argument that it is unconstitutionally vague didn't need to be considered by the court. Legal challenge ignites political finger-pointing. The victory prompted a campaign opportunity for Peterson, who is running to be the Republican nominee for state attorney general. In a press release announcing the win, the Gilbert Republican criticized Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays for not defending the laws in court, accusing her of abandoning the state's responsibility to safeguard communities. Peterson and Montenegro, as the Senate President and House Speaker, intervened in the case. The legislature will always stand up for victims and protect our communities when those elected to do so refuse to, Peterson wrote. But that characterization is nothing more than a misleading political attack, Mays spokesman Richie Taylor said. The Democrat was never a party in the lawsuit because Doe sued Maricopa County Sheriff Paul Penzone, who at the time was responsible for enforcing Arizona's sex offender registration laws. Penzone declined to participate, noting that the job of a sheriff is limited to carrying out the laws. That's when Peterson, the president of the state Senate, and then Speaker of the House Representatives Ben Thoma, jumped in. In his bid to cast Mays as soft on crime, Peterson has increasingly mobilized the legislature to take on lawsuits that he later touts as proof that he is the better candidate. Taylor noted that despite Peterson's claim that Mays isn't interested in defending the state's sex offender laws, she's been involved in a different lawsuit, seeking to topple new additions to them since last year. In 2024, lawmakers expanded the number of people who are posted to the state's sex offender website to include more level 1 offenders and created a new requirement for sex offenders with children to report their child's name and school. Months later, three people who would be affected by those laws filed a lawsuit claiming their civil rights are being infringed and questioning their constitutionality. The legal challenge, which is ongoing, aims to permanently block the laws. And that concludes this first story. Judge rejects claim that Arizona's sex offender registry violates constitutional rights. Our next story, Trump pardons 11 Arizona fake electors as Attorney General faces deadline to refile her case. Federal pardon doesn't apply to state charges, but Mays indicated she may drop case. By Jared McDonald Evoy, November 10, 2025. President Donald Trump pardoned Arizona's, quote, fake electors over the weekend, along with a number of other high-profile supporters who spread election misinformation and attempted to help the president overturn the results of the 2020 election. Last year, the fake electors were indicted by a grand jury for signing bogus documents claiming that Donald Trump won the 2020 election after Trump's campaign allegedly urged them to do so. Trump is identified in the indictment as, quote, unindicted co-conspirator one. In April 2024, an Arizona grand jury indicted 18 people for their involvement in efforts to fraudulently overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election after Democrat Joe Biden won the state by around 10,000 votes. All of the fake electors involved in the scheme were indicted, including Arizona Senator Jake Hoffman, leader of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, former Arizona Senator Anthony Kern, member of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, and Tyler Boer, Turning Point Action USA COO. In May, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Sam Myers agreed with arguments from attorneys representing the fake electors that prosecutors had failed to disclose the full text of the Electoral Count Act to the members of the grand jury prior to the indictment. Myers ruled that Mays would have to convene a new grand jury and share the text of the act in its entirety if she wanted to move forward with the case. An appeals court didn't take up the matter. Trump pardoned Hoffman, Kern, and Bauer, along with others involved with similar schemes in other states. However, the pardon only applies to federal charges, so the Arizona indictment brought by Attorney General Chris Mays would not be impacted. Both Wisconsin and Nevada still have similar ongoing cases. A spokesperson for Mays said the pardon will have no impact on the state's case and declined to comment further. Those indicted for being fake electors in the scheme and named in the pardon are Kelly Ward, former AZGOP chairman, Arizona Senator Jake Hoffman, leader of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, former Arizona Senator Anthony Kern, Tyler Boer, Turning Point Action USA CEO, Michael Ward, husband of Kelly Ward, Nancy Cottle, a Republican who's been active in local politics for a decade, James Lamon, a failed 2022 U.S. Senate candidate, Robert Montgomery, former chairman of the Cochise County Republican Committee, Samuel Moorhead, former chairman of Gila County Republican Party, Lorraine Pellegrino, former president of the Ahwatukee Republican Women, Greg Safston, former executive director of the AZGOP. The case brought by Mays is facing an upcoming deadline on November 21, where the Democratic AG can choose to either allow the case to be dismissed or revive it. Mays indicated to local NBC affiliate 12 News over the weekend that she may drop the case. Each of the 11 Trump electors were charged with 9 felonies related to trying to subvert the election, including conspiracy, fraud, and forgery. All of the defendants pleaded not guilty. Attempts to reach those named in the pardon went unanswered or declined to comment due to the nature of the ongoing case. The indictment also included other people who worked for the Trump campaign or alongside it to facilitate the fake electors' work. Rudy Giuliani, an attorney for Trump and one of the main points of contact for the Trump campaign as it sought to overturn the 2020 election and ensure Trump would serve a second term. Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff in 2020, Christina Bobb, the Republican National Committee's senior counsel for election integrity and a former attorney for the Trump campaign, who was accused in the indictment of making false claims of widespread election fraud in Arizona and in 6 other states. John Eastman, a former Trump lawyer who is facing possible disbarment in California for his attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Boris Epstein, a former Trump aide who is still one of the former president's advisors. Jenna Ellis, a former attorney for the Trump campaign and conservative media personality who was censured for making false statements about the 2020 election and who pleaded guilty in October to a felony charge in Georgia for her attempts to overturn the election results. Michael Roman, a former Trump campaign aide who was also indicted in the Georgia case. Giuliani, Meadows, Bob, Eastman, Epstein, and Ellis are also included in the same pardon. In total, Trump pardoned 77 people involved in efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. Sean Morales Doyle, Director of Voting Rights and Elections at the Brennan Center for Justice, told the Arizona Mirror that the pardon sends a message to those who may try to subvert future elections that they'll have the backing of the president, much like his pardon of those involved in the January 6 insurrection sent a similar message. I think the pardon is a shift in the environment in which people are acting and people who might be tempted to try to challenge legitimate outcomes and subvert the outcomes of elections have to think about the consequences of doing that, and this changes the set of outcomes they may face, Morales Doyle said, noting that Trump's pardon will not impact state charges or local charges. Unequivocally, the president has no authority over state criminal prosecutions. Despite that, Trump and his allies have been attempting to push the boundaries of his federal powers. In March, Trump issued an executive order aimed at voting, seeking to add a requirement to show a passport or similar proof of citizenship to vote. But the courts placed a permanent injunction on it on Halloween, citing the president has no authority over elections because the Constitution plainly gives that power to states and Congress. While Trump may have the ability to pardon his allies, Morales Doyle noted that states and local governments still have the ability to enforce their own laws that Trump cannot issue pardons for, creating additional checks and balances. However, it is all part of a broader trend that has Morales Doyle worried. It is a shame, but it is true that our federal law enforcement, our system of federal law enforcement, has become increasingly politicized under this administration, Morales Doyle said. This politicization is part of a broader strategy to undermine our elections, where federal law enforcement is used to pursue bogus election fraud claims, along with other efforts to undermine the election, Morales Doyle said. And that concludes this story. Trump pardons 11 Arizona fake electors as Attorney General faces deadline to refile her case. Next up, Arizona Democrats bless 7 senators who caved on health care demands. Party leaders say senators forgot what this shutdown was about in Sunday vote. By Caitlin Sievers, November 10, 2025. Democrats in the Grand Canyon state are furious at the 7 U.S. senators from their party who voted with Republicans to end the federal government shutdown Sunday without a deal to stop skyrocketing health care premiums. Since the federal government shut down on October 1, all but a few Democratic U.S. senators repeatedly voted against reopening and promised to continue doing so until Republicans agreed on a deal to protect the Affordable Care Act subsidies that help people afford health insurance. That changed Sunday night when those 7 Democrats, Dick Durbin of Illinois, John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, Maggie Hassan and Jean Sahin of New Hampshire, Tim Kaine of Virginia, and Catherine Cortez Masto and Jackie Rosen of Nevada, and an independent who caucused with the Democrats, Angus King of Maine, voted to end the stalemate because Republicans agreed to pay food aid, rehire furloughed federal workers, and schedule a vote on those health insurance subsidies for next month. The Maricopa County Democratic Party wrote in a statement that the Democrats who voted to reopen the government seemed to have forgotten what this shutdown was about, protecting the Affordable Care Act. And now, because of their votes, we could lose the historic legislation passed by President Obama and see our healthcare system dismantle in a matter of days. Arizona's U.S. Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, both Democrats, voted against the resolution to reopen the government again on Sunday, as they have every time a vote has been taken. At a time when prices are already too high, Americans are shopping for health insurance and experiencing such sticker shock that they are being forced to sign up for a crappy, overpriced plan or not sign up for insurance at all, Gallego posted to social media Sunday. Kelly on Friday took to the floor of the U.S. Senate to share the struggles that Arizonans will face if the Affordable Care Act tax credits aren't extended before the end of the year when they expire. The senator said he's heard from a Buckeye woman whose health insurance will go from $600 to $1,000 per month without the credits, and a Yuma family of five whose premiums will spike from $560 per month to $3,100. Kelly accused President Trump and the Republicans who controlled the Senate of ignoring the suffering of the American people, 42 million who have gone without federal food aid since November 1 because of the shutdown. Instead, they focused on Trump's new ballroom, golfing, and a costume party at Mar-a-Lago, Trump's Florida residence, he said. There is no reason why we can't agree on this, Kelly said. If you want to reopen the government and you want to help keep insurance premiums from spiking, then let's do it. But if you say no, if you say you can't vote for something like this, well, let's just be honest about it. Kelly blamed the situation on Trump and congressional Republicans' decision earlier this year to extend $4 trillion in tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans while refusing to extend tax credits to help everyday Americans afford health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. The Maricopa County Democratic Party called out the Democrats who caved on Sunday and voted to reopen the government after the longest shutdown in U.S. history. Arizona Democrats will not stand for this, they said in a statement. But then again, Arizona Democrats aren't like the others. We're fighters. We're willing to stand up to MAGA and defend our values. Now that the federal government is on track to reopen, Arizona might soon have one more Democratic representative in Washington, D.C. Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva, who won a special election to represent Arizona's 7th Congressional District by an overwhelming majority on September 23rd, has been waiting since then for Representative Mike Johnson, the Louisiana Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, to swear her in. Johnson has for weeks made numerous excuses for the unprecedented delay, but had promised to seat Grijalva once Democrats agreed to reopen the federal government. In a Monday statement, Grijalva said she was headed to the nation's capital with the expectation that she'll be sworn in once she arrives. The delay never should have happened in the first place, she said in the statement. For 7 weeks, 813,000 Arizonans have been denied a voice and access to basic constituent services. This is an abuse of power that no speaker should have. While Grijalva said she was pleased she'll finally be able to officially get to work, she was disappointed that her first vote won't be to stop spikes in the cost of health insurance. For people working paycheck to paycheck, paying double for health care is not an option, she said. A promise for a vote is no guarantee that relief will come and means little coming from leaders who blocked my swearing in and continued to protect Trump at any cost. Grijalva and other Democrats have accused Johnson of pushing back her swearing in to prevent her from being the 218th vote needed to force the release of the FBI's case files concerning pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Republicans have largely opposed doing so because Trump is reportedly featured in those files, as he and Epstein were close friends in the 1990s before they had a falling out. Johnson denied those allegations. That concludes this story. Arizona Democrats blast 7 senators who caved on healthcare demands. Our next story, student advocates demand ASU follow UA in Rejecting Trump's Education Compact by Jared MacDonald Evoy, November 7, 2025. Former and current students joined Democratic lawmakers on Friday to urge Arizona State University to follow the lead of other prominent schools, including the University of Arizona, and refuse an offer by the Trump administration to expand federal funding if they agree to a series of demands aligned with Republican policy positions. ASU currently is not one of the schools that has been offered the, quote, Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education that was rejected last month by UA, but the school has been providing feedback to the administration on the compact. ASU has long been a voice for change in higher education. President Michael Crow will share his vision for higher education with students, families, and the administration, an ASU spokesperson said in a statement to the Arizona Mirror. As President Trump's team seeks new and innovative approaches, ASU will share its ideas, and it is important to note that ASU has not received any kind of compact offer. There is nothing for the university to accept, reject, or negotiate. But Democratic lawmakers and student advocates are voicing their concern about the compact and asking preemptively that ASU does not agree to join the compact if offered. This compact doesn't build a better future. It builds barriers. Yudit Nanthi Sanchez, a graduate student at ASU, said during an Arizona Student Association press conference at the Arizona Capitol, the compact would force universities to change their policies and structure to align with President Donald Trump's view of how higher education should operate. For example, schools that sign the compact should not consider race or sex during the hiring or admissions process or restrict employees from sharing any political views. They also would have to shutter departments that spark violence against conservative ideas, and much more. Mika Dyer, an ASU student and coalition director for the Young Democrats of Arizona, said the compact is a politicalization of education and would put Arizona's educational future at risk. Dyer, who studies political science, said that if ASU were to sign on to the compact, it could risk silencing an entire generation of thinkers and doers who may otherwise be interested in the state and the university. The compact would also require that employees and students be anonymously polled to monitor compliance with the compact, which some speakers said resorts to a form of surveillance on the university and its students. Representative Brian Garcia, a Democrat from Tempe, said he and Senator Lauren Kuby, a Democrat from Tempe, both have reached out to ASU voicing their concerns. U.S. Representative Greg Stanton also sent a letter to ASU President Michael Crow, urging him not to agree to the compact in any form. Proposals like these are an overall detriment to the communities we serve, Garcia said, adding that if ASU were to agree to the compact, it would damage the school's reputation and have long-lasting effects. All the speakers said they have reached out to the Arizona Board of Regents, ASU, and the governor's office about their concerns. ABOR directed the Mirror to Chairman Doug Goodyear's previous statement, saying it supported the University of Arizona's response. Crow previously told the state press, ASU student newspaper, that signing the compact is, quote, not viable. The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment. Our state budget is squeezed right now, Representative Cesar Aguilar, a Democrat from Phoenix, told the Mirror when asked what other options may be on the table if ASU were to refuse the compact and be denied some federal funding. He explained that the state has a long list of things that have been on the back burner in regards to budget priorities. In a little over 2 months, lawmakers will be back at the Capitol and state budget negotiations will begin again. Whether those negotiations will include additional money for universities in light of the compact remains to be seen. And that concludes this story, Student Advocates Demand ASU Follow UA in Rejecting Trump's Education Compact. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Our next story, Arizona GOP defends abortion laws with witnesses who are vocal abortion foes. The witnesses have never performed abortions, but claim Arizona's restrictions protect women. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, November 8, 2025. Republicans defending laws that require women to wait 24 hours and have an ultrasound before getting an abortion say the state statutes don't violate the constitutional right to abortion that Arizona voters overwhelmingly approved last year. But their legal case is built on the testimony of expert witnesses who have never performed an abortion and have long opposed it. Last year, 62% of Arizonans cast their ballots in favor of Proposition 139, adding abortion as a fundamental right in the state's constitution. But dozens of restrictions on the procedure remain enshrined in state law, and only the courts can strike them down. In May, reproductive rights groups filed a lawsuit challenging several of those restrictions, arguing that they conflict with the new constitutional protection. The statutes ban the mailing and prescription of abortion pills via telehealth, prohibit abortions because of a fetal genital abnormality, and require doctors to conduct an ultrasound and recite state-mandated information 24 hours before performing an abortion. Over the past 3 days, reproductive rights attorneys have made their case for why Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Gregory Como should at least temporarily pause enforcement of the laws while litigation continues. They've gotten testimony from local abortion providers and medical experts about how the laws undermine the ability of women to access abortion care. At the same time, the legal team for Senate President Warren Peterson and House Speaker Stephen Montenegro, who have taken up the defense of the laws, have argued that they are safeguards intended to help inform and protect women from negligent care. But their first witness on Thursday was an OBGYN with no experience providing abortion care, and reproductive attorneys said zero understanding of what impact the laws have on patients. That trend continued on Friday during the case's final evidentiary hearing. Internal medicine doctor, abortion targets a small human being. Dr. Christian Collier, a professor of internal medicine at the University of Michigan, spoke in favor of Arizona's laws that force doctors to recite state-mandated information to patients and delay performing an abortion for 24 hours. Collier, who has never performed an abortion, justified her testimony as an expert witness by saying that she has studied and taught courses about medical ethics and informed consent. The law that requires abortion providers to recite state-mandated information is frequently referred to as informed consent. It requires doctors to share details about the fetal development stage with the patient and say that alternative options, like adoption, are available, the father is financially liable, and that there are organizations that can help if she chooses to continue her pregnancy. Reproductive rights attorneys claim the law preempts the ability of doctors to tailor their care to individual patients and can lead to emotional distress for vulnerable patients. Collier disagreed, saying that patients should be fully educated about their health care choices, and the state needs to step in to ensure a minimum information threshold. If you leave the decision to the physician to decide unilaterally what to include in the consent process, you would leave out information that may very well be necessary and relevant for the patient to make a truly informed decision, she said. Lauren Baxt, an attorney with the Center for Reproductive Rights, questioned the value of Collier's testimony. Collier's training is in internal medicine. She has no formal training in medical ethics, isn't certified as a healthcare ethics consultant, and doesn't work as a clinical ethicist. And, Becht said, Collier's testimony is undermined by her personal opposition to abortions. In a statement filed with the court, Collier wrote that a small human being is targeted for death in the process of abortion. She has also previously claimed that abortion is rooted in violence, and once tweeted, "Holding on to a view of feminism where one fights for the rights of all women and girls, especially those who are most vulnerable, I can't not lament the violence directed at my prenatal sisters in the act of abortion done in the name of autonomy." Como seemed unconvinced by arguments that Arizona's mandated information law is necessary, pressing Collier on whether she is aware of any other medical procedure that the state has similar regulations for. She responded that while some procedures, like living organ donation, triggers the use of federally mandated consent forms, she doesn't know about any comparable state examples. So for some reason, the state of Arizona has singled out abortion as the only medical procedure to tell doctors what informed consent is, Como said. Pro-life activist Prop 139 is, quote, evil. Myra Rodriguez, a former employee of Planned Parenthood Arizona, who has become an anti-abortion activist and vocal critic of the organization, claims she observed negligent practices during her employment that justified the state regulating how doctors provide abortions. Rodriguez, who is not a doctor, has never performed an abortion herself. During her testimony, Rodriguez shared a graphic story of a woman who returned to a Planned Parenthood clinic with fetal remains in a napkin after a medication abortion, complaining that the doctor didn't properly explain what the procedure entailed. Rodriguez frequently books speaking engagements with anti-abortion organizations where she shares similarly graphic stories. Center for Reproductive Rights attorney Caroline Sacerdote pointed out that Rodriguez has also called Prop 139 evil, highlighting her bias in a lawsuit that directly involves the impact of the constitutional amendment. Nurse makes tens of thousands for anti-abortion testimony. Maureen Curley, a psychiatric nurse who specializes in women's reproductive and mental health, claimed that requiring doctors to share information about alternatives with patients is critical because many of them are unaware of their options beyond termination. The largest population that seeks abortion are younger women under the age of 25, and oftentimes they get their information through social media, through peers, through oftentimes not reliable sources of information, she said. In Arizona, the vast majority of women who obtain an abortion are 25 and older. In 2023, the latest year for which there is data, 61% of abortion patients were 25 or older. ACLU attorney Joanna Zacharias pressed Curley on her lack of objectivity about abortion care, noting that the retired nurse submitted a filing to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2005 advocating for an end to the procedure. The most effective way to preserve and protect the psychological health of women from the detrimental and lethal effects of abortion is to bar the procedure, she wrote in an amicus brief for McCorvey v. Hill, a case that sought to overturn Roe v. Wade. And that isn't the only court case Curley has joined in support of abortion restrictions. She has also testified in favor of anti-abortion laws in North Dakota and Missouri. Curley admitted on Friday that she has been paid at least $22,000 for her testimony in those cases. Friday was the last day for attorneys to interview witnesses to support their positions and convince Como to side with them. But a final decision won't come for several more weeks yet. Closing arguments are scheduled for January 12th. And that concludes this story. Arizona GOP defends abortion laws with witnesses who are vocal abortion foes. And our next story follows up on the first. Expert testifies Arizona abortion laws undermine women's autonomy and health. The expert witness for Republicans backing the law, meanwhile, has never performed an abortion. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, November 7, 2025. Arizona laws that restrict how and when women can terminate their pregnancy infringe on the fundamental right to abortion voters enshrined in the state constitution last year. Attorneys for two local abortion providers argued in court on Thursday. Over the course of a six-hour evidentiary hearing, the legal team for the doctors called on Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Gregory Como to at least temporarily block multiple statutes that regulate abortion while litigation continues. The laws ban the mailing and prescription of abortion pills via telehealth, prohibit abortion solely because of a fetal genetic abnormality, and require an ultrasound, the recitation of state-mandated information, and a 24-hour delay before an abortion can be performed. Dr. Paul Isaacson, Dr. William Richardson, and the Arizona Medical Association, represented by attorneys from the Arizona branch of the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Reproductive Rights, contend that those laws fall afoul of an abortion rights amendment that 62% of voters backed in 2024. Proposition 139, also called the Arizona Abortion Access Act, made abortion a constitutional right and explicitly forbids the enforcement or adoption of laws that interfere with that right before fetal viability. The only exceptions are laws that don't undermine a woman's autonomous decision-making and are intended to improve or maintain her health in ways that are consistent with clinical standards and evidence-based medicine. In the second of three hearings held on Thursday, reproductive rights attorneys emphasized that criteria to prove that the laws restricting abortion care in Arizona violate the new constitutional protection. Dr. Catherine Wenstrom, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Brown University, who also provides abortions and specializes in high-risk pregnancies, testified that Arizona's ban on abortions because of fetal genetic abnormalities directly undermines a woman's autonomy. Referred to as the, quote, reason ban scheme, the law has frequently been criticized by local abortion providers who say it operates as a gag rule that prevents them from freely counseling their patients for fear of being forced to deny them care. Doctors who knowingly violate the law could face between 2 and 8 years in prison. Wenstrom said that threat necessarily puts the doctors and patients at odds and strips women of their decision-making power at an incredibly vulnerable time. Especially in these situations, the patient needs to feel that they're in control of what happens to their own body, she said. The reason ban makes it clear that you can only be in control of your body if you sneak in, disobey the law, don't tell anyone why you're having the termination, and deprive yourself of all the added support that you would get if you were allowed to discuss it. ACLU attorney Rebecca Chan zeroed in on that assertion, questioning Wenstrom whether, in her professional opinion, the law complies with the strict criteria baked into the state's abortion rights amendment. If opponents of the law can persuade the courts that they don't comply with that criteria, the laws would effectively be rendered unconstitutional and unenforceable. Does prohibiting doctors from providing abortions if they know the patient's reason advance or maintain the health of the patient seeking abortion care? Chan asked. Is it consistent with accepted clinical standards of practice? Is it evidence-based medicine? Each time, Wenstrom replied in the negative. Wenstrom also denounced the laws requiring ultrasounds and the recitation of state-mandated information 24 hours before performing an abortion as onerous and harmful. She noted that ultrasounds aren't always necessary, especially if a woman's estimate of her last menstrual cycle places her pregnancy in the first trimester, when less precision is required for doctors to perform an abortion. Determining where a pregnancy is in the second trimester is more urgent, as that's when fetal viability comes into play. Wenstrom was particularly critical of the state-mandated information doctors are forced to recite to patients. The information covers alternatives like adoptions, the father's financial responsibility, and even an explanation of the fetus' current development stage, which Wenstrom said could cause emotional distress. Anti-abortion attorneys attempt to extend fetal viability. On the other side of the debate are top GOP leaders in the state legislature who intervened to defend the laws when Arizona's Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays declined to do so. Senate President Warren Peterson and House Speaker Steve Montenegro are hoping to convince the courts that the laws don't violate the new constitutional standard and can remain in place. To do that, their legal team has sought over the past 2 days to characterize the laws as nothing more than safeguards and have worked to cast doubt on assertions from reproductive rights attorneys that the statutes unduly burden both women and doctors. Justin Smith, an attorney for Peterson and Montenegro, pressed Wenstrom on her claim that mandatory ultrasounds don't take into consideration the differences between patients. Smith asked Wenstrom if she performed ultrasounds on her patient. Wenstrom said that she had, and that doing so is in line with recommendations from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists. So then that doesn't interfere with the woman's autonomy, right? Smith asked. It's for her health. Wenstrom disagreed, saying that ultrasounds aren't so much for the mother's health as they are to collect basic data about the pregnancy. She added that if a patient perceived an ultrasound as violating their autonomy, they would simply decline it, something that some of her patients have done. But Smith dismissed those patients as the exception and not the rule in an apparent bid to prove that ultrasounds don't violate a woman's autonomous decision-making ability. Smith also questioned Wenstrom about fetal viability and post-viability abortions. While fetal viability has generally been regarded as being around 22 to 23 weeks, determining when a fetus can survive outside the womb and an abortion shouldn't be performed isn't an exact science, and abortion foes have long tried to push back that deadline. Smith noted that in July, a boy born at 21 weeks in Iowa became the world's most premature baby, and posited that the same could happen in other cases. Now we have proof that a baby at 21 weeks can be viable, right? He asked. But Wenstrom was skeptical, pointing out that it was one isolated case among the country's 4 million annual births. Smith asked Wenstrom whether she considers aborting a fetus at viability unethical, and pressed her over whether she had ever performed an abortion of a viable fetus. That prompted an interjection from Como, who questioned the relevance to the debate. Reproductive rights attorneys are focusing their challenge on the enforceability of the laws on pre-viability abortions, so questions about how they apply to viable fetuses aren't currently at issue. Smith argued that establishing viability is imperative because Prop 139 leaves that up to doctors to determine. He pointed out that while Wenstrom said viability could start as soon as 21 weeks, Isaacson on Wednesday testified that he had performed abortions as late as 23 weeks. Under the constitutional standard, viability is determined on a case-by-case basis, Smith said. The relevance here goes to when the recent ban would actually be taking effect. If Wenstrom's standard had been upheld, Isaacson's Wednesday testimony could have been thrown into question, and statements his attorneys are relying on as evidence would have been nullified. But Como wasn't convinced by Smith's line of reasoning and directed him to move on. Abortion foes make a second bid to shut down the lawsuit. After reproductive rights attorneys wrapped up their portion of the evidentiary hearing, opening up the floor for their counterparts to build their own case, Smith made a motion to end the litigation process and for Como to issue a ruling. The motion alleged that the reproductive rights attorneys hadn't sufficiently proven that the challenged laws are unconstitutional, and because of that, Como should rule in favor of Peterson and Montenegro. Smith argued that because the laws covered actions that are sometimes appropriate and in line with the criteria of Prop 139, an ultrasound isn't always necessary, but it could be helpful. For example, they shouldn't be thrown out. The plaintiffs failed in their case to prove that there are no set of circumstances for each one of these provisions in which the law would not have been a constitutional application, he said. Caroline Sacerdote, an attorney for the Center for Reproductive Rights, objected to that characterization and said that, in fact, the legal term for Peterson and Montenegro have so far failed to prove that the laws being challenged comply with the strict criteria in Prop 139. We maintain that the challenged laws interfere with the fundamental right to abortion prior to viability as a matter of law, she said. Intervenor defendants have certainly not met their burden of showing that interference with the fundamental right is justified under the strict scrutiny required by the amendment. Ultimately, because abortion is a constitutional right, the legal burden of proof falls on Peterson and Montenegro. In a ruling rejecting an early attempt by the duo to quash the lawsuit, Como noted that any restrictions on abortion access are presumptively invalid because of Prop 139, and it's the responsibility of the backers of those laws to prove they are constitutional. On Thursday, Como reiterated that view and denied Smith's motion to force a final determination. A third hearing has been scheduled for Friday, and Como said he hopes to issue a ruling soon after. Anti-abortion doctor advocates for the preservation of restrictive laws. Attorneys for Peterson and Montenegro questioned one witness on Thursday support their assertions that challenged laws improve the provision of abortions in Arizona. An OBGYN who has never performed a single abortion. Dr. Stephen Garth Nelson, who runs a women's health clinic in Phoenix, admitted that he's never performed an abortion and refuses to refer patients out to abortion clinics for elective procedures. But he defended his testimony as an expert on the subject by pointing out that he has observed multiple abortions, studied the procedure, and frequently performs dilation and cauteric procedures for women suffering miscarriages. Commonly called a D&C, the procedure is used to remove fetal tissue from a womb and is also used in abortion care. Reproductive rights attorneys objected to Nelson's testimony, arguing that he's unable to understand the difficulties posed by the challenged laws that abortion providers endure and are forced to watch their patients struggle with every day. But Como allowed his testimony, reasoning that being educated on abortion care was sufficient. Nelson spoke at length about his support of the challenged laws, saying that ultrasounds are critical for ensuring patient health, and criticizing the interest in conducting initial abortion consultations over video or phone call. It would be extremely difficult to determine if a patient is being coerced to obtain an abortion over the phone without being able to observe their body language, he said. In a bizarre moment, when asked whether identifying changes in tone during patient consultations is a regular part of his responsibilities as a physician, he became visibly emotional. Medicine is an art, Nelson said, beginning to cry. It is an intimate human-to-human art, and when we take away or begin to strip away the aspects of that interaction that detracts from the optimal care, I think we're not fulfilling our obligation to provide appropriate care. Despite never having performed one, Nelson was asked by attorney Emily Gould to describe a dilation and evacuation procedure which is used during the second trimester abortions. Nelson provided a prolonged and graphic explanation describing the crushing of fetal bones. Following objections from reproductive rights attorneys, Como requested that Gould clarify how discussing the procedure relates to the challenged laws. Gould tied the discussion of dilation and evacuation procedures to the ultrasound statute. "We need an ultrasound to properly plan for and prepare for this procedure," she said. But reproductive rights attorneys rebutted that the lawsuit doesn't seek to challenge the ability of doctors to perform dilation and evacuation procedures. Instead, it's focused on the pre-viability enforcement of the abortion restrictions, which has to do with the first trimester and not the second. During the first trimester, medication abortions are the most common. In Arizona in 2023, the last year the data is available, 95% of abortions were performed in the first trimester, and more than half of those were medication abortions. Nelson framed the laws as guardrails intended to keep women safe amid negligent doctors. But Haley Crawford, a deputy solicitor general in May's office, questioned whether he was at all involved in drafting the laws or debating their merits with lawmakers. He replied that he had not been. "So you don't know whether the Arizona legislature enacted or adopted these laws for the limited purpose of improving or maintaining the health of an individual seeking abortion care consistent with acceptable standards of practice and evidence-based medicine," she concluded. Although he allowed Nelson to testify, Cuomo appeared skeptical about his testimony, pushing back on assertions that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's approval of mifepristone, the most widely used abortion pill, should be questioned. Nelson was particularly critical of the agency's collection of adverse events involving the pill, calling it insufficient. Como pressed Nelson on his mistrust of the FDA, asking what other agencies or resources he relies on to make decisions about which medications he prescribes. Nelson, who testified that he prescribes abortion pills to help women dealing with miscarriages, admitted that he still relies on the FDA's determinations, despite his qualms. And we're going to have to leave that update there, because that's all the time we have for this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by SunSounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Remember, if you missed any part of this program or want to hear a story again, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also get our stream and podcasts on our SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and also listen on your Echo Dot or smart home device. And don't forget to spread the word to your friends and neighbors that anyone who is unable to read print for any reason can find lots of great programming on SunSounds 24/7. Have them check us out at sunsounds.org. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Stay tuned for more great programming from SunSounds of Arizona, and we'll look forward to having you join us next week.